going to work with Boaz Barak and Manoj Prabhakaran. Boaz just had a just had a baby, so he couldn't join us here, unfortunately. So I am left to give the talk. Okay. So right. So our old friend Zirinalj proofs. We all know them. All, of course, we have our prover verifier, and the prover is trying to prove that some statement X is in some language L. So they talk to each other. And we have our usual soundness and completeness requirements. And in addition, we have, of course, the zero-knowledge requirement that the verifier learns nothing beyond the statement, that the statement itself being proven. And the way we formal this, of course, as we all know it, is that suppose the adversary somehow, you know, thinks he got something out of this. Well, we can, in fact, imagine a situation where all we do is we have a simulated adversary here, and we just tell him that X is in the language. And if he can, on his own, simulate everything the adversary would have seen in a real interaction, then we say it's zero knowledge. Okay, so this is this nice two-party setting for zero knowledge that's been extremely useful to us over the years. But over the years, there have been other concerns that have come up. So, for example, we can imagine a situation in which we look at the two-party scenario, but now we add some more interaction. Let's say that the adversary now is in fact talking to many provers at the same time, some concurrent, adversarially interleaved manner. And now we have the same concern. We want to say that even in such an interaction, the adversary shouldn't learn anything, and we can formalize this, as we did before, by imagining a world in which we have this simulator. And all we do is we tell it all the statements that we're going to be proving. The honest provers on the left will be proving. And then, again, this simulator will be able to imagine everything that the real adversary would have seen in its real interaction with all the different provers. And if we can do that, then we say that it's concurrent zero knowledge. Another issue that has come up in the context of multiple parties is when we look at the old scenario with the prover and a verifier, but now we put the adversary in the middle. And the adversary is going to act as a verifier in talking to this honest prover, and act as a prover when talking to this honest verifier. And now, what are the problems that we could imagine? The main problem we could imagine is that the adversary, through its interaction with this honest prover, is somehow able to prove something to the verifier that it couldn't have proven on its own. Right? So that's the problem that that we would like to prevent, and
how can a 91 paper be based on a
99 paper? No. There's an original definition. It's very complicated. There's a bunch of new definitions. I'm just showing one that's based on something. There are many definitions, many different papers. I'm just giving you one. This here. Yeah. The one I'm illustrating here is this paper. But there are many others, many equivalent to others, and many maybe not equivalent to others. And I'm just telling you what I like. So, okay. So the way that we can think of this is we can again imagine this, you know, this imaginary world with a simulation, and in the simulation we just tell it what the statement is that's being proven on the right. We don't actually give it the interaction with the honest prover. And now we can again simulate what the view of the adversary would have been in real life, but in addition to that, we're actually also able to extract a witness for whatever the adversary proved, if he did successfully prove anything, in its right-hand interaction with a verifier in the simulation. So again, the intuition here is that we were able to actually extract the witness from the adversary, even when he wasn't given anything except just the name of the statement being proven on the left. So he somehow was able to prove it on its own. If we can guarantee this, then we have a kind of non-malleability. This is the simulation, soundness, extractability, flavor of non-malleable zero knowledge. But let's not worry about that for
right now. So what he's proving on the right is some statement regarding the same L, or not necessarily the same L?
The same language, you mean?
The same language? It's a different
Let's assume that we're always talking about some empty complete language.
A single language. Okay. So, but it might be a different X. It is a different X. Right.
Sure. Right. Okay. So these are notions. And then there's a natural question. What if we consider sort of the most general situation? So now we have the adversary who's in the middle, but now he's talking to many honest provers, many honest verifiers, and he's trying to do something sneaky out of this whole complicated situation. And so this is what we're going to deal with in our work. It's been dealt with before. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Here again, we can define security in a similar way. We'll give our simulation just these statements that are being proven on the left. And with that, we should be able to get a simulation of its entire interaction with everyone, together with all of the witnesses for any statements that it successfully proves on the right. Okay, and that's this sort of general, concurrent, non-malleable zero-knowledge notion. So as I said before, some people don't like the fact that I use pictures for everything. So just to make this formal, I'm going to give a somewhat more formal English-based definition. So basically what I just said can be translated to the following. We can say that for all polynomial time adversaries A, there is a polynomial time simulator S, such that for any polynomial number of theorems that we want to prove, so any polynomial subset of the language, if we just give the name of the theorems to the simulator, it'll output a view and these variables z1 through zm, with the property that the view is computationally distinguishable from the adversary's actual view in its interaction with honest vector of provers, which actually have the witnesses, of course, the adversary, and a bunch of honest verifiers. Okay, so that's condition one. And second is that z1 through zm are actually going to be valid witnesses for all the statements proven by A to the honest verifiers on the right in this simulator view. Okay, so let me just make a couple of notes about this definition. And by the way, I'm going to try to finish early so we can get to lunch still on time. Let's see if that happens. One thing I want to say is that this definition, even though it looks kind of messy, you can actually formulate in a UC-like manner with this idea, with an ideal functionality that's closed under self-composition. I assume everyone knows what I'm talking about, but I won't actually do this. Now, one of the things that was in the definition I just gave before was a restriction, which was that, you know, I talked about the subset T from the language. Fixed. The set of statements was somehow just fixed in advance. And that's a big restriction, this idea that the honest party's inputs are just fixed in advance. It's being used in some sense implicitly in a lot of works like this, concurrent commitments and other things. I just want to make one more point, which is that even so, the adversary's inputs, of course, can be adaptive. So we're not restricting the adversary, we're just talking about the honest party's inputs that there are.
Adversary's input is the
right-hand
side, and the honest party's input is the
left-hand
side axis? Is that it?
Yes, right. The adversary's inputs are, let's say, whatever he's planning on proving.
So fixed in advance just means non-adaptive, right?
Yes, non-adaptive, right? I did want to make a point, which we'll talk about this later, but we can actually relax this later. So we don't really need exactly non-adaptive, and I'll talk about this more after I get more into the protocol. But for now, let's just think about fixed in advance. And in fact, we are going to talk more about this issue of fixed and advanced inputs, and we're going to give an impossibility result actually for when we talk about general functionalities beyond zero knowledge, even when the honest party's inputs are not adaptively fixed. Also, I'll talk about this, of course, more later. Okay, so let me also just talk a little bit about the context of our work. There's tons of context. So there's a lot of previous work on this, trying to achieve concurrent, non-malleable zero knowledge. And they basically fall into three categories, what I would say at a high level. There have been a number of results that are based on super polynomial simulation for concurrent, non-malleable zero knowledge. That's super polynomial simulation, so not the standard definition. We're talking about polynomial simulation in this talk. Another sequence of works looked at concurrent non-malleable zero knowledge, but with bounded concurrency. So there's an a priori upper bound, polynomial upper bound on the number of concurrent sessions that can ever be happening. We, of course, don't have such an a priori upper bound. And the other sequence, I would say, there are many papers here beyond this one, are ones where you talk about global trusted setup assumptions. So we have a common reference string, or a key registration functionality, or identity-based setup. There are many different flavors that you can talk about here. And again, crucially, this work, the reason why it's new and novel is that we don't require, we talk about polynomial simulation, we talk about general concurrency and no trusted set of. So we obtain the first such protocol in the standard model. Right. And now let me go straight into talking about the protocol, and we'll talk about many things afterwards as well. All right. So what are the ingredients? There are a lot of ingredients in our brew that we're going to cook up here.
This doesn't contradict any impossibility of that?
Yes, yes. Very, very carefully, you know. There's like this jigsaw puzzle, and we noticed there was one space missing, so we quickly, you know, put our found a piece and stuck it in. Okay, so what are the ingredients, right? There's a and in fact, actually, by the way, I think that is actually interesting. What one thing that makes this interesting, you know, that there are all these impossible results, there are all these, you know, other results, and it's actually really fascinating to see where exactly the line lies between impossibility and possibility.
Are you black box?
What's that?
Are you black box?
Yes, in fact, we're even black box. I think. Let me mention a little more about that later. Okay. Alright, so the ingredients. So the first thing we're going to use is a statistically hiding commitment scheme, which we'll call S-con. We know this can be constructed from any one-way permutation based on the famous Novi result, or you could use collisions and hash functions, or your other favorite assumption that gives this. Again, this means a commitment scheme where the message is hidden information theoretically, and binding is computational, of course. Another thing we need is an ordinary, that's a two-party, statistical zero-knowledge argument of knowledge, which we'll call a squawk. And we'll use it for any, we need it for any NP-complete language. So how do we make such squawks? There's nothing really involved here. It's really just a folklore modification of a well-known construction. Adam told me that Broussard, Chan, and Krupow were the ones who did this first. I must admit I've never read their paper. Okay, let me just tell you, for those of you who haven't, like me, let me just tell you what the basic idea is. Take our famous, our favorite zero-knowledge proof, like the Hamiltonicity zero-knowledge proof, but instead of using a perfectly binding commitment, use a statistically hiding commitment from the prover to the verifier. And we're not going to care about round complexity, at least especially in this talk, so let's just repeat it sequentially k times. So now we have a negligible soundness error, statistical zero knowledge, argument of knowledge. Okay. So more ingredients. We'll also need an ordinary, non-malleable commitment scheme. Okay. Let me actually tell you what the definition of such a thing is. We consider, again, the sort of three-party case where we have a sender, a receiver, and the adversary in the middle. And this sender commits to some value x, and simultaneously this adversary commits to some value a. And then we consider another situation where the honest guy commits to some value x prime different from x, and then if the adversary commits to some other value a prime. Okay. And what we require is that a and a prime are computationally indistinguishable. In other words, the adversary's choice of what to commit to can't depend on what this honest left-hand side guy committed to. So even though x and x prime might be completely different strings, easily distinguishable, the adversary's commitment shouldn't be distinguishable.
So is this commitment with respect to opening or
the? This is commitment with respect, no, with respect to commitment. There's no opening ever. The book talks about it. Okay. So. This notion of non-malleable commitment was first introduced by Dolev, Dvorak, and Naur, and then there's more recent work by Hassan Rosen. And again, as often happens in this field, so this definition is again one of many definitions you can imagine. The original definition of Dolev, Dvorak, and Naur was different, but we believe that the definition that they have implies this definition. These things are very subtle. There might be some crazy bot that shows up that kills it, but we think that that's the case. Certainly, the reconstruction of Poisson-Rosen does satisfy this. And one thing I want to mention, which is kind of interesting, is that we don't need concurrently non-malleable commitments. Okay? So Poisson-Rosen recently had a really nice result where they show how to do concurrently non-malleable commitments with respect to commitment, so no opening in that world either. And you might think that seems like it would help us, but in fact it doesn't seem to really help us, and we don't need it. So that's just a little note. I want to mention about the black box thing. So Dolo, Dork, and Naor, their construction is black box, right? So assuming that they do achieve this definition, which we do have a reduction written down, then everything's fine. If not, then we have to use Bausen Rosen, which is non-black box.
Yeah, I mean, under what assumptions do these commitments?
This is just trapper permutations. Actually, in fact, even less. One-way permutations, you can do everything alone. Everything that we're talking about, we can do with one-way permutations. Even better, one-way functions. But let's think about one-way permutations in the talk, just because it will be helpful later on. So let me just mention one other thing. Another thing about non-malleable commitments, we're going to make a few assumptions about them. First of all, we're going to assume that our commitment is statistically binding. Okay, so once you make a commitment, then in this NMCOM, then you really are information theoretically bound to the string. Okay? And in fact, furthermore, we'll even assume that the first message of the protocol defines the message in the statistical sense. And this can be assumed about all the known protocols. Another thing we'll assume is that the non-malleable commitment protocol has an associated proof of knowledge. In other words, we can actually In that experiment, we can actually extract what the guy committed to on what the adversary committed to on the byte. And yes.
So just a quick question.
Sure.
The first message. So if you use DDN and Naor's commitment, that's actually two rounds, right? The verifier, whatever receiver sends a message, and the committer sends the next message. So what do you mean?
Wait. The Dolodork, the DDN commitment is a login round commitment, and
just the first message. I don't understand what you mean by first message, because if protocols, standard protocols, it's the first message
Good.
From the receiver. To
right. That's why I want to, at least for the purposes of this talk, just think about one-way permutation-based commitments. So then I can just send you a single thing to begin with, and you're committed information thread. We actually don't, we can relax this, but it's just going to be much easier to think about if we have this restriction. Okay? And anyway, we need one-way permutation because we need statistically hiding commitments, so we might as well do it. Okay. The final ingredient that we'll need is the concurrent zero-knowledge protocol of the joint with Manoj and Alon. I'm going to talk about this in more detail, which is why I'm spending some time on it. So this is actually quite important to our proof, so please pay attention. Okay. So how does it work? The way that it works is that the verifier chooses a random secret S, and then he picks k squared, let's say, splittings of the secret into two additive secret chains. Okay, so we have these R1, 0, R1, 1 up to RK squared, 0, RK squared, 1. Okay? And the verifier first just uses a perfectly binding commitment to commit to all of these values, all of these random values. Then we have a k-round protocol in which the prover will send to the verifier just a sequence of k bits. And what the verifier will do is he'll open the corresponding r's in the next batch of random strings. Okay? But for each one, he's only going to open one of them. Right? For each pair, he only opens one. And so in that way, the prover shouldn't really learn anything about the string s. So why would we do something like this? So we do something like this because of its usefulness in simulation. So let me, so we've called this the PRS preamble. Okay, so when we do this kind of protocol, we call it the PRS preamble. So again, why would we do something like this? Just to give some very high-level intuition first, the idea is very simple. The idea is that you might imagine that we're going through a protocol execution, and the prover asks for, he sends some sequence of bits and some number to get revealed. This happens many, in these k rounds up to some point, let's say the ith round. And then what we can do is we can rewind back the simulation. So just reset the adversary back to an earlier state, where the adversary again is the verifier, and then continue along a different path. And in this path, what we'll do is we'll use fresh randomness for this path. So with high probability, these query bits will be different. And all we need is one to be different, and as soon as one is different, if we have a successful opening by the verifier here, then we can recover the secret S. That's the main idea. And we do this many, many times so that we have a really high confidence, even in a concurrent setting, that we will be able to recover the secret S, which we'll show, we'll talk more about later. So again, there are many, so this checkmark just means that we actually recovered the secret S. Of course, there are a lot more issues to be dealt with here, which we'll talk a little bit more about later. Okay, so finally that we have all the ingredients in our hand, we can talk about our protocol. The protocol begins with the PRS preamble. The verifier chooses the secret S and goes to the PRS preamble with the prover. Then the prover uses the statistical commitment just to commit to nothing, just to commit to junk, a bunch of zeros. And he follows it with a squawk that just shows that he knew what he committed to. Okay, so it gives an argument of knowledge about what he committed to. Then the verifier goes ahead and reveals all of its PRS secrets. Then we have this ordinary non-malleable commit, which we use to commit to the witness W. The prover uses it to commit to the witness W. And finally, we give a squawk that either of two conditions hold. Either we committed in this phase two commitment to the PRS secret S, which of course shouldn't happen in real life, right? Because in real life, at this stage, the prover doesn't know the secret S. So he shouldn't be able to do this. So that's one way that he can win, but he won't in real life. Or that he actually committed to the witness using this non-malleable commitment. So one of these two conditions hold. Yes?
Is there any significant difference between the two acronyms? One's a...
Oh, sorry. Sorry. Yes, they're completely different protocols. No, this is don't you know, O's and A's commute. You know this by now. So, okay, anyway, yeah, of course, sorry, this should have been a S-C-K A-O-K. A-O-K. Okay, and of course, as I just mentioned, in real life, the prover will use this option, because he will actually commit to it. So the protocol is, yes?
Will you be addressing the issue of why you need statistical zero knowledge and computation?
Yes, I'll talk about that. All right, so proof of security, right? So how do we prove these kind of things are secure? As always, we do this by giving a set of hybrid experiments, right? And I'm going to talk about this at a high level just for right now. Okay? So, you know, we're going to set up a bunch of hybrid experiments. We have to show that each hybrid is indistinguishable from the next. And here is where the statistical zero knowledge, the fact that we're using statistical commitment and statistical zero knowledge in a lot of places ends up being very, very useful to us. Sometimes it's very easy. We just change something and, well, the adversary's view is not even changed information theoretically, right? So everything is okay. Sometimes, of course, it's not that easy. That it could never be the case that everything goes so nice so easily. And we actually need, of course, to give an actual reduction. And in particular, for example, at some point we're going to have to say that if an adversary can distinguish some hybrid from the next, then we can build another adversary that can break the ordinary non-malleable commitment. Right? We're definitely going to do that at some point. And that's really where the problem comes in. That's really where the difficulty is. Because, of course, the simulator that we're going to propose is obviously going to use this the rewinding that we need for the PRS preamble. We're going to have all this rewinding going on. But so the adversary A is being rewound many times. But the adversary A prime can't do any rewinding, right? It actually has to play the ordinary non-malleable commitment game, right? There's no rewinding that it can do in that game. So we have to somehow be able to convert a rewinding simulation into a non-rewinding adversary that can break the non-malleable commitment. And that's sort of the main interesting. So, as I just said, so the main technical work is to show that we can make a reduction go through, even though we have this PRSR winding going through. And I'm going to hide many, many, many details. Okay, so at a high level, how will these hybrids, hybrids work in our security? Well, we start with our protocol, and of course we want to end up with our simulation. Right? So what do we do? We're going to use the fact that we have the PRS preamble here and the PRS simulator, the rewinding-based simulator, to actually recover the secret S. So in our simulation, we're actually going to do all this rewinding, and by the time it reaches this point, the prover will actually know the secret S. The simulator will actually know the secret S. And so, instead of committing to zeros, it'll actually commit to the secret. This is a statistical commitment and a statistical zero knowledge argument of knowledge. So, again, this is one of those easy reductions, right? Because it's still, the view of the adversary is still completely indistinguishable. Information theoretically indistinguishable. At some point also, we're going to need to get rid of our dependence on witnesses. So in some of these hybrids, we're actually going to change the non-malleable commitment from a commitment to the witness to a commitment to junk. This is going to be more interesting stuff. And then, of course, we're going to change which option we use in the last proof to make the whole thing go through. So just a high-level description of the hybrids. And as you might guess, based on what I've already said, this is really going to be the tricky part, is going to be to go from a non-malleable commitment to the witness to a commitment to junk. So to describe how that works, we have to go into a little bit about how the PRS rewinding and simulation work. So let me just give you an image with sound effects of the PRS simulation. Okay? So this is what it looks like. We go forward, then we rewind, then we go forward and rewind, and so on and so forth. And in case you can't see the structure of this, it's actually a very simple structure that we have. We have these pairs of challenge responses, and it's a recursive pattern, right? So that's the way that it works. That's the idea of the simulation. And finally, it's this bottom line that actually gets outputted, right? So that's the one that we actually output at the end. All the others are look-ahead threads that we go to look ahead, find out some information, and then we just kill off those threads. All right.
Why did you rewind twice basically the same thing?
Sorry, where are you?
So,
up, down. You got the lizard player? Sorry, which?
Didn't you seem to already extract?
Oh, well, why are we doing this twice? It seems like we're doing it twice, right?
Right.
Is that what? Yeah, this is a very technical answer to that. Basically, we're in this concurrent situation where there are lots of different verifiers, lots of different provers, lots of different secrets, lots of different verifiers, lots of secrets to extract. And we need actually many, many chances to extract the secret in order to be able to have high confidence that we will be able to extract it. Because remember, the adversarial verifier need not oblige us, right? We might actually rewind back. So we're going here and we rewind back, and now in this time he doesn't bother to give us an answer. He just shuts up, right?
Well, then, do we even draw it though?
Yeah, well, yeah. So all of these things can be essentially pruned by the adversary in some way. We have to show with high probability we'll still be able to get it. If the adversary gets to the end at all, then we'll have figured out the secret.
These messages are from different sessions, not just all
the same. Right. These could be different. This could be verifier one, this is verifier two. Even this could be, you know, verifier two and verifier one. We don't know. The adversary can change things on us. So it's complicated, and I'm not going to get into the details of the PRS.
So
when
is it that every verifier has its S?
Yes.
So every instance has this, and you have to extract all of them?
Yes.
All S.
Exactly. We have to extract all of them, and we have to extract them by the time, in any particular session, by the time we reach the end of the simulation, we should have extracted S. And in fact, that's exactly what we get. So we get this guarantee. That if at any point along the simulation we've actually reached a point where for some verifier, some adversarial verifier, we've reached the end of the PRS preamble, then with overwhelming probability we'll actually have figured out what the secret is for that verifier before we reach that point. For any polynomial number of verifiers, we don't have to know how many verifiers to begin. Okay. So that's the sort of high level setup. And now Okay, now I was thinking about the hard thing here is to do this non-malleable, this NMCOM reduction, right? So let's say that we were going along our simulation, and at some point we encounter the first message, this binding message, of the non-malleable commitment in some session I. Okay? Now, at this point, we need to be able to somehow make an argument that, well, if we change this commitment from the witness to zero, then we can reduce that to an adversary that will be able to win the simple one-on-one non-malleable commitment game, right? And here's where we make these observations, that we know, again, that we've learned some set of secrets so far, up to this point, right? And what we assert is these are actually enough. These are all the secrets we need, because what we'll do is, from this point onward, we're actually going to go ahead and we're just going to have a straight line simulation of this from this point forward. Okay, and in this straight line simulation, we'll use the secrets that we've extracted already, if we can, and for everything else, we'll actually use the witness. and again, the main point is the only sessions on which we'll have to use the witness are sessions that are after this one. Because for any session where we've actually reached the first message already, we've already extracted the PRS secret, right? So we can go ahead and use the PRS secret for that part of the simulation, and only for the other ones we have to actually commit to the witness. Okay? And in this one, of course, we have a choice. We can do either way. We can either use the witness or use the secret, and that is exactly what gives us the reduction. Okay, so that's the high level idea of the proof. One thing just to see, you know, we have to order these hybrids in a somewhat clever way also. And the way we do it is we just look at this PRS rewinding, and we just look at the order that the first messages appear in. And that's going to be the order of hybrids. So whichever first message appeared, you know, first in the simulation, we start with that one changing from the witness to zero, and then the next one we change in that order. And that way we're able to maintain this invariant that we're always okay. Yes.
Not the first to complete the preamble, it's the first to start the preamble.
This is the first message in the non-malleable commitment protocol.
Oh, okay.
So preamble is done right after. Okay. So right. But it's not the first to complete the preamble, it's actually gonna be the first message. Makes it work better.
Can you explain again why it is the case that you cannot rewind anybody during this non-malleable commitment?
It's just from the definition, right? So if you remember back to the definition of non-malleable commitment, there's no rewinding going on, right?
Uh-huh.
I have to actually exhibit for you an adversary that gets from the external world messages from the honest verifier, message from the honest prover,
mm-hmm.
and I have to somehow build such an adversary, right? That adversary can't rewind this external verifier or the external prover. So that's why from this point onward, we're not going to do any more rewinding, right? And we're okay.
And is it crucial that your definition, I mean, you say it's by definition, but, I mean, could it be that you change the definition and everything goes away? I mean, it's
which definition?
Well, that you allow rewinding into a non-malleable commitment definition and everything goes away? I mean,
right, so some sort of resettable and non-malleable commitment, maybe it would make the proof much easier. But we don't have such things I know of. So there are, of course, many additional details on... For example, we're also going to have to do a witness extraction, right? That's also part of this definition that we have. And for there, of course, we have to make sure that soundness still holds, even when we have some of this sort of rewinding going on. But it turns out we can use similar kinds of techniques to the ones we just talked about to make all that go through also. And here, I just want to make this point that because we were doing this rewinding, right? This having concurrently non-malleable commitments don't seem to really help in that case, right? Because in any case, we need to rewind in the middle of the commitment, and so having concurrent non-malleable commitment doesn't seem to give you any additional properties. However, we do still...
In the middle of what commitment?
What's that?
Which commitment do you need to rewind in the middle of?
Okay, so I was saying that I gave you this technique that we have, right, where we go through this PR submission, and we stop, and then we continue, right? So for that, we only need an ordinary... three-party non-malleable commitment, right? There might be a hope that, well, maybe if we have concurrent non-malleable commitment, we don't need to do all this. We can do something simpler, a simpler proof strategy. But that doesn't seem to be the case, right? Because the proof strategy still has to involve rewinding, and then we're stuck, because concurrent non-valid commitment doesn't give you resettable non-valid commitment. Okay, there is still a use though. If we use the commitment that Klaus and Rosen show to be concurrently non-malleable, which they call a one-many non-malleable commitment, then we actually do get some additional properties. So we get something you can call strong concurrent non-malleable witness and indistinguishability, where what it means is that here we can even show that if you change what you're proving to on the left, then the entire set of witnesses on the right will be indistinguishable, even if you change what you proved on the left, the witnesses used on the left. So that's something that's a stronger property. For that, we do seem to need to use the Pastor-Rosen style commitments. But I'm not going to get into that. I think these things could have application to, for example, this input indistinguishable computation. Okay. So let's come back and let's talk about this input selection thing, this adaptive versus non-adaptive thing. So as I said, in our definition, the honest part inputs were fixed in advance. And first I want to mention that we can actually relax this to the following kind of funny looking thing. Okay. So what we could assume is that instead of just having non-adaptive inputs, let's say that for each honest party, there's a public, so everyone knows it, polynomial time algorithm, which is the input select algorithm. And what this algorithm does is it takes the entire history of everything that's happened so far, and it outputs the statement that the honest parties are supposed to prove next. So it can be adaptive, right? It can be adaptive based on everything that's happened so far, but the main point is that it's public. So everyone knows what the statement is going to be. You can predict what the statement is going to be. No, it can be randomized. But still, everyone knows the distribution of statements that are going to be. So this does seem like a funny definition. It's certainly not full adaptive definition, but it's interesting to note that this sort of funny definition is still all that you need for something like a GMW style application of zero knowledge. So if all I'm going to do is prove that I've acted honestly so far, then the statement is known to everyone, right? The statement is that everything I've said so far is consistent, right? So everyone knows what the statement is going to be. It's not fixed in advance. Does depend on the protocol execution, but nevertheless, it's sort of predictable, and that's exactly what we need, so we can actually make the proof go through in such a case. And this is one of the reasons why we would think that this protocol we hope it's going to be useful in perhaps some concurrent security game-based definitions. Now, these don't use our protocol. I'm just saying that these two works explore this kind of sort of direction where we talk about instead of using the UC model to define what concurrent security means, you can just define some security game which involves some horrible concurrency and still has some desired properties. So you can imagine that's a separate way of defining security for more complex objectives, and then try to achieve them in some way. And because of these properties, we think maybe our techniques can be useful.
Those papers you mentioned, they use something else?
Yeah. These don't actually need the non-malleability part of it. But just to show that people have started looking at this direction, then maybe
this
in the future they'll use
this. What you said, what's useful? You're talking about specifically this funny, weird thing with input selection, or the whole thing in general?
Well, the whole thing in general, the techniques, but also I think this, just the fact that it does have this property, makes me think that, I mean, there are not that many situations you can think of in real life where the statements are always fixed in advance, right? That seems kind of ridiculous. You're never going to find that situation. But this sort of situation we do find, for example, in GMW applications of zero knowledge. So that's why I'm hopeful that these techniques will be useful.
You need to give it a name.
Okay. That's a good point. Please let me know if you have any suggestions.
Weird programming. Predictable.
Yeah. Something like predictable honest inputs. Okay. So, but let's look a little bit more at what. Sorry. What?
No, I was going to say, if you like the people like Domingo Minsa Kayo, I was just looking at Fuse's technique.
Let's look a little bit more about what's going on with this input selection stuff. So, sorry, I have this big long statement here. I didn't have enough time to animate it nicely. So, the intuition I think from all these things come from rewinding. Just thinking about the fact that all these simulations, if you don't have some sort of global trusted setup, you're going to have to do some kind of rewinding intuitively. Even the non-black box techniques are essentially doing some kind of rewinding in disguise. So there's always some sort of rewinding going on. And then this leads to sort of a natural problem. So suppose that it was really adaptive input selection for honest parties. Well, then in particular, there could be some honest party that selects the statement that he's going to prove in some completely unknown, adaptive, unpredictable way based on his secrets, right? So how do these things work? When we go through the simulation, when we go through it the first time, we can ask sort of the ideal model, hey, what's your input going to be? And it'll tell you, you know, you ask the environment, what's the input going to be? And it'll tell you, right? But then when you rewind back, let's say you rewind back before the start of the protocol, and now the adversary changes what he does in other interactions, and we get to the honest party's beginning of the protocol. At this point, he's going to tell us some statement that he wants to prove, but we can't even predict it in the simulation, right? We don't have the honest party's secret, so we can't even predict what statement he's going to prove. So how can we even think about doing a simulation? That's sort of the high-level conundrum that we have, which is why it seems hopeless to try to get something for an application. Also the fact that it's provably impossible, that's another thing. Okay, on the other hand, if we think about honest inputs that are fixed in advance, so forget about the thing I talked about in the last slide, let's talk about the original definition, just everything is fixed in advance, then it doesn't seem like there's any such problem, at least for the zero knowledge case, and we can ask the question, what about for general tasks? What if we're talking about other things that we want to do besides zero knowledge? Well, for this, let me give you some more rewinding-based intuition.
Can I just ask you one thing?
Yes.
What did you say is provably impossible? You said, what is provably impossible?
Okay, so in natural definition, according to polynomial simulation, zero knowledge with adaptively chosen inputs in this sense is provably impossible to achieve. That's the result of many people, including you, Linda.
This is one place where you bypass the possibility results of the input.
Yes, exactly. Because our input selection is not done in this way. Okay, but now suppose we were just going to be content with, you know, inputs that are fixed in advance. Okay. So can we hope to get a general result that hey, we can achieve multi-party computation with fixed and advanced inputs in a completely composable way? Well, to give an idea of the kind of issues that can come up. Think about a 1 out of k of
only. This is not going to be impossible.
So just keep listening. Okay. So consider a 1 out of k, a 1 out of k of Möbius transfer protocol. Okay. And let's say that the sender is honest and the receiver is dishonest. Okay. So then, let's suppose that the sender's secret inputs are all fixed in advance. So they're all fixed in advance. They have these k secret strings. In the ideal world, right, where we just do this protocol once, well, what happens? The adversary learns exactly one string. He learns the output string, right? Whichever one he selected. But in any simulation, if we're going to have some kind of rewinding going on, then at some point, you know, we'll rewind back and let's say the protocol starts again, and now the adversary just changes his choice. Maybe he selects it at random. And then he's going to get, sort of legitimately, he's going to obtain different strings, right, with each rewinding. And yet, you know, in the simulation, we only had access to the one that we got from the ideal model when we asked it once, right? So unless we can reset the ideal model, which again is not necessarily a reasonable thing to do, we're kind of stuck in this situation. So there's just some intuition to show that it's not zero knowledge is not likely to extend to the general case, and it would be nice if we could actually show an impossibility result for oblivious transfer in this setting. We can't quite do that. We don't know how to quite do that. But we do, in fact, show a general impossibility result for zero knowledge and oblivious transfer combination functionality. So just think about it as a proof that you can't have concurrently an unmalleable zero knowledge and oblivious transfer together. You can't have both these things happen together. And this is just an impossibility result.
So
yes.
It seems to me like the problem, at least the intuition, is that the receiver has an input. So could you do it in general for functionalities where the receiver doesn't have an input?
That's pretty much zero knowledge. That you can almost define zero knowledge in that way. That it's a functionality where the receiver has no input.
This is not a finite functionality, or is it the zero knowledge and OT?
Well, yeah, the zero knowledge part is not finite. So It doesn't make sense in a finite world. So that's true. We don't have a result for finite cases. Okay. So So how will this work? I guess I'm not going to keep my promise of ending early. Let me try to give you the high-level outline of the proof. So the idea will be we're going to first talk about this general technique called the chosen protocol attack,
okay,
which involves zero knowledge. And what that says is that for every zero knowledge protocol, pi, there's another protocol, phi sub pi, that doesn't compose with it, that doesn't compose nicely with it. This is the general result. It's almost folklore at this point. Then we're going to convert this chosen protocol, phi sub pi, into a sequence of functionalities that won't compose with pi. And then finally, we'll use Yao's garbled circuit technique, to actually compile these functionalities into something which just involves zero knowledge and no Bloom's transfer. And that's how we're going to finally get our result. And again, the main point is the first such general impossibility result for fixed honest input distribution. So if you just fix them in advance. All right, so first, what's this chosen protocol attack thing? So we have this general situation. We have Alice the prover talking to our adversary on the left. This would be like a zero knowledge proof. Then we have this phi sub pi protocol that's going on here, and Bob is an honest player in that protocol. We have a secret input W, which is given to both Alice and Bob. And there's a public input, which is just going to be a one-way function, let's say, applied to the W, okay, which is Y, and that's known to everyone. Okay? And what Alice does is it uses a zero-knowledge protocol, in fact, a zero-knowledge proof-of-knowledge protocol, to prove that it knows W such that Y equals, you know, F of W. Okay? That's what's happening on the left. And on the right, there'll be this funny protocol, phi sub pi, which I'll describe now. So I'll describe it sort of interactively. So the way that it works is we imagine that there's this zero-knowledge protocol that's happening, and there's, you know, other protocols that go along this side. At this point, it's just the same as the zero-knowledge protocol, okay, the phi sub pi. But then what Bob does is he checks, did I get a valid proof? Okay, so if I got a valid proof of knowledge that you know, this guy knows W, then I just go ahead and send a W. Okay, so I just go ahead and send W to the adversary. So trivially, obviously, this protocol, you know, doesn't compose well with the zero-knowledge protocol, right? So trivially, if we run this protocol concurrently with pi, then the adversary learns W, just because that's the way I defined it. So nothing surprising there. And on the other hand, if we replace the zero-knowledge protocol with an ideal call to a zero-knowledge functionality, then it is secure, right? As long as that protocol really was a sound proof of knowledge, then unless the adversary already knows W to begin with, it's not going to be able to give a good proof that it knows W. And so it won't learn W, right? So in this situation, when we have the ideal world, then the adversary can't learn W. And that's the basic idea. The idea is that you have this, you know, you give me a protocol, I'll choose an attack on it that definitely won't compose with it. So a very general result applies in almost every situation you can think of, except for some global stressed situations. Okay. So what are the next steps? So first, we're going to build upon this scenario, and this is actually implicit in this work of Kelsey, Schneier, and Wagner, more explicit than Lindell and many others. So we're going to try to solve some problems that we're not done yet, and here's why. Well, first of all, we have a protocol, not a functionality. I wanted to show that functionality is impossible to achieve. And furthermore, it depends on the protocol pi, right? So even if it was a functionality, it actually depends on the specific protocol pi. I want just a functionality that's impossible to achieve. So let's look at the first problem first. So the idea will be that we have this protocol phi sub pi, and instead of using just having these messages here, we're going to replace them with in this idealized protocol, we're going to replace them with these ideal functionalities. We're just going to call f1 up to fk. And the idea is very simple. These ideal functionalities are just the function that computes the ith verifier message for the protocol phi sub pi. So in this way, we can essentially replace all the steps of the protocol here with these functionalities. And Bob's input will always be just, will be W and the randomness that it uses for the protocol, right? We always get the same input to this functionality. And at the end, it'll still have the same property, right? The, it won't compose well with this particular protocol, pi, zero knowledge protocol. There's a problem with this. The way I defined it, the problem is that the adversary doesn't need to behave correctly with these functionalities, right? So it could actually, for example, try to run the simulation strategy. And in that way, somehow it, it's able to actually, in the end, give a valid proofs transcript. So we have to be careful about that. And the way that we solve this problem is also very simple. We just take this functionality and go and add max to it. So whenever it whenever the functionality outputs a transcript, it also outputs a max on that transcript. And then whenever it receives a transcript from the adversary, it expects it to be mapped, right? So in that way, we're forcing the adversary to behave in this protocol-like straight-line manner, right? So the only thing you can do is, you know, give the first message, get the second message back, which is signed. Give the set, you know, the signed message back and get the next message, and so on and so forth. So that's how we resolve that problem. So far, you know, what have we done? We've kind of solved this. We have now functionalities, F1 up to FK. So that's good. But these FIs still depend on the specific protocol pi, right? So that's definitely not good. These kind of issues have been dealt with in the past. So for example, in Yehuda's result, he dealt with this issue that, you know, it depends on this protocol pi just by saying, well, I'll use any bit transmitting functionality, okay? And then I'll just run the protocol on top of that functionality. Okay? And that was perfectly fine for him. But it's not fine for us, because if we do this, then it requires the honest party inputs to be adaptive, right? Because then we're just running the protocol by means of some arbitrary other functionality. Okay. So we can't do that. So instead, what we do is we apply Yao's garbled circuit technique. And what we do is we use the Yao garbled circuit idea to compile these functionalities, fi, into invocations of an oblivious transfer functionality. And the way, and we can exploit several things in this impossibility proof, because we know we're in a situation where the sender is always honest and the receiver is always dishonest, right? So in these oblivious transfers, it's the adversary who's supposed to be getting the next message in the protocol, right? The signed, you know, transcript of the next message in the protocol. So the sender is always honest, so we don't even need to prove the correctness of the garbled circuit. And as such, we can just imagine that the garbled circuits are just fixed inputs to the receiver, and the garbled input encodings are the, you know, inputs to the sender. And these are just chosen randomly once and for all, and they're fixed as inputs from then on to the receiver and the sender. And so in this way, we replace all these FIs with just these transfers. So finally, you know, what do we have here? We've gotten rid of all these. We replace it with these oblivious transfers. And again, the Bob's inputs are always fixed. They're just these fixed, randomized Yao garbled circuit and their encodings. The adversary can still implement the original phi sub pi strategy on top of these functionalities, just by choosing his just by basically following along the original strategy translated to these garbled circuits. And so in this situation that I just drew here, the adversary will in fact learn W. So in particular, if these OTs are instantiated with any particular protocol that have the OT property, they won't compose with the zero knowledge protocol. Right? So we have an impossibility result in that sense. And the only thing left to do, just to finish it, is that if we of course replace the zero knowledge protocol with an ideal zero knowledge invocation, then we have to show that the adversary doesn't learn W. But that, again, follows along exactly the same lines that we sketched earlier. So that's the way this impossibility result works, and you get that you can't have both zero knowledge and oblivious transfer. Okay, so just to conclude, so again, we give the first concurrent non-novel zero knowledge protocol in the standard model, with polynomial assumptions, polynomial simulation, all that good stuff. And we also extend this impossibility result of Lindell to show that the negative result actually works with oblivious transfer and zero knowledge in this fixed honest party input model. So we again drew that impossibility line, you know, a little bit further. And as I said before, I think nonetheless, even though we have these impossibility results that show that we can't really extend our protocol to get a general result for multi-party computation with fixed honest inputs, it still seems like the technique should be useful if you go outside the UCE model and think about things like these security game-based definitions.
So what is the hope here, Mitz? What is the hope concerning the last bullet? What would be the ultimate hope?
I don't think there's any ultimate hope, unfortunately. I think that you can think of, we have all these impossible results, now you can think of specific problems. So for example, both of these papers deal with blind signatures.
You already have general feasibility results for these indistinguishability based on bounded simulations.
Right, so, I mean, there are many things to discuss here about, you know, when is something meaningful and when isn't it. Here, the advantage is that we could hope to get polynomial security games with polynomial assumptions, which is something that we can't hope to get using unbounded simulation.